Hello, and welcome to Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by Sam, and we're going to be continuing our discussion of Secret Wars, covering issues 9 through 12. Sam, how you doing tonight?
I am great, John. How are you?
I am doing well. A little tired, but I'm doing all right, and I am looking forward to this home stretch of Secret Wars. This, again, was kind of my gateway drug into the Marvel Universe. I think I was getting Fantastic Four and maybe Alpha Flight before this. But I hopped on board of Spider-Man and Avengers and X-Men and just about everything else around this time.
Yeah, and this is just before I was reading any Marvel, really. I started Spider-Man just after this, so.
And this was a great time to be reading Marvel. They were doing some good stuff. I think this was definitely a breakthrough series for them. Sure, it started as a tie-in to a toy line, but hey, I was the right age for the toys, so I got those too.
Yep.
Probably still have some of those somewhere. What surprised me is I did a little bit of research after we recorded last time, and there were not all that many action figures in the line.
Okay.
There was only, I'm going to say, maybe a dozen or so. And out of the second wave of figures, some of them weren't even in this series.
Really?
Like Daredevil?
Yeah, I can see. Yeah, okay.
I'm trying to remember what some of the others were. Maybe Falcon or something? I forget.
Did they get all the ones that were in the series at least?
Oh, not even close.
Really?
There are so many characters here.
Yeah, it's weird that they'd move on to ones that weren't in the series before finishing the ones that were.
Yeah, again, there was only, they did Cap, Spider-Man. Man, I really should have thought to have pulled the notes up for that. I remember they did, like, Kang and Doom on the villain side. I'm trying to remember if they did Doc Ock or whatever. But, there were a ton of them. Because you've got, 20 or something or so heroes, a dozen or so villains. It would be a fairly full line of action figures. I'm actually more curious if they've done it as part of like the Marvel Legends line.
Huh.
Because again, I think it's an iconic era of Marvel.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So, and I'd gotten a couple of the playsets or whatever too, but they were the like 4-inch action figures, not crazy well articulated. Everybody had their gun and remember if they had jetpacks or whatever, but you know what I mean. So not up to my current standards for action figures, which are more the 6-inch super posable types. Of course, those cost a fair amount more than those Secret Wars ones did back in the day. Shall we jump into issue 9?
Sure, let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah, where we left off, Galactus, his stomach was rumbling. He was about to devour the planet. And of course, that's never good, particularly when you're on said planet that's about to be devoured.
Yep.
We start with Colossus getting wind of it and still worried about the healer who is still in her coma-like state after healing the Wasp. And then we get, just a couple of people like Storm, trying to attack Galactus and the X-Men, trying to deal with him. And of course, he's just still putting his machinery together and sending, drones and whatnot to go fight them. And it's one where we get some good action sequences early on. We also then get the Avengers before too long kind of, rallying to go help the X-Men. And there's aspects of this era of comics that I think from a current perspective seem a little silly or corny or whatever. Like when the Avengers and the Fantastic Four have hopped in the jet they've got, the equivalent of a Quinjet, it's not literally a Quinjet, it's an alien version or whatever. They're trying to reassure the Hulk that even though he's not at his peak of brilliance as Banner or his savageness as the Hulk, he's still a valued team member. And there's just having a couple of panels taken for that as they're about to go fight Galactus just felt weird. Not wrong, not bad, but it would be hard to pull that kind of thing off today, I think.
See, I half agree and half don't. I half feel like you're right. They wouldn't do that today, but I also feel like if they do, it'd be a whole issue or two dedicated to that.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I think it would have played out differently. I think it would have been more Hulk having, I don't say the inner monologue, because we certainly wouldn't have that today, but it would not be as blatant as it was here, where Thor is talking to him and Hulk's flat out, I gained the intelligence, I'm losing that now, I'm not smart enough, I'm not savage. It wouldn't be verbalized as clearly, but I think you're right. There there is the possibility that we would have had an issue-long...
A mini-series dedicated to it or something.
Yeah, you know, Hulk man or monster sort of a mini-series to duel it out or something.
Yeah.
So I do think you're right, we get some of the same sort of story beats today, but the execution of them is so different.
Yeah.
And there's an aspect of today's decompressed storytelling versus this era of almost super compressed storytelling, where inside of particular panels, you get this whole almost mini subplot of, is somebody fit for battle or not? Is this the right plan we're going down, or what have you?
Yep.
So, you know, we also then get a page of Ben Grimm, you know, worried he's not going to, you know, carry his weight because he's not the thing at the moment. And then, of course, as he gets, you know, frustrated by that, he turns back into the thing. So there's a bunch of stuff here that are interesting character moments, but everything down to the one panel where Iron Man is keeping an eye on Spider-Woman because she's this new unknown quantity. Mm-hmm. And besides, she's got great legs. And I'm like, wow, that was interesting. I would hope that wouldn't play that way today, at least not with that character. I could see one or two others you could do that with, but it just seemed rather sexist. But it's also a matter of, you know, again, this story was written back in the 80s, and social standards and whatnot, what was considered acceptable or whatever, is different than today. Certainly not going to say that excuses anything, but if you try to look at some of this through today's light, it comes across very differently than it was ever intended, I think.
Yes, I agree. I some of the other things we talked about previously, particularly with the way the Wasp is depicted almost throughout this entire series,
mm-hmm.
and Volcana, and this seems one of like the least noticeable thing.
Well, and I'm certainly agreeing with that this is not like the height of the insanity or outrageousness. I really think the fat shaming for Volcana that we talked about last time, it's like, where is that coming from? In terms of, she doesn't look the least bit overweight compared to any of the other characters we've got there.
Well, yeah, and like I said, the almost total vapidness of the Wasp throughout the series.
Yeah, yeah. But I think this was also an era where the stories were told with broader brushstrokes in terms of the script, and everything was a little bit more pronounced. Because it kind of had to be. They were going through the story rather quickly. You didn't have the slower pace we've got today to, I don't say wallow in the minutiae, but to really have the in-depth conversations to get to some more subtleties than just, hey, we've got a panel here where we're going to use some thought balloons to literally get inside of the head of this Iron Man.
Yeah, fair enough.
And this is also, I think, the first issue where we get James Rhodes' name in this. We knew it wasn't Tony, but it took him until this ninth issue to actually identify himself, even in his own thought balloons.
Yeah, I think you're correct.
Which, if you think about it, it's kind of funny because, you know, I usually don't try to identify myself to myself in my own thoughts.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm assuming, but again, that becomes a matter of necessity.
Oh, yeah, it's storytelling convention.
But I mean, the fact that it took, basically, if you already knew, you already knew.
Mm-hmm.
And you just figured it was Rhodey. And then in the last issue, or the issue we talked about last time, he's definitely identified as being, you know, of African descent and skin color.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, if you don't realize at that point that it's James Rhodes, the name's not going to do you anything.
Well, yeah, because either you know who the character is or you don't. And if you don't, like you said, what good does the name do you? It's interesting, though, because to a degree, Tony is a character in this story just by his absence.
How so?
Well, there are times that Rhodey is getting compared to, or people have expectations of, well, Tony would have done this or Tony would do that. So they're looking to him for those things.
That is true. The fact that Reed is kind of the brain trust all alone with Cap as the leader and Iron Man gets left out of that, I guess you could argue, shows just how missing Tony is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, his presence is felt the same way Kitty's is in terms of not there for Colossus, etc. It's not a major story point, but it is in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And that's one of the things I like, because, again, Sue Storm, her absence is felt throughout all of this too, sometimes more so than others. But it comes down to, this would be a very interesting version of the story if Tony had been there instead of Rhodes, if Sue had been there instead of, you know, being pregnant back on Earth, and if Kitty had had shown up.
Well, and then you get kind of the end of this where Reed vanishes. And then you get into that whole Reed and Galactus talking.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I got to admit, the beginning of where this story starts to become more comic booky and less comprehensible.
I think the teleportation of Galactus, his machinery, and the whole mountaintop, yeah, that was a little kind of out of the blue and, you know, what's going on there. To me, it didn't bother me because it gave Reed and Galactus a chance to talk, which I don't want to say is a bookend to Doom being in Galactus's ship, but you know what I mean.
No, I agree with that. It's just here's where, to me, this story goes from kind of comprehensible sci-fi to really wacky.
Mm-hmm.
To this point, most things make sense. And from this point on, things make a lot less sense.
Well, I think there's some things that have happened before that make sense if you just sort of assume certain things. You've got to assume that the ever-changing conditions on this planet in terms of both the state of the planet, the state of the heroes, the villains and stuff, that Doom's plan is always constantly changing.
Okay.
So when we had a while back, he sent the Wrecking Crew to go fetch the Lizard because he needs him. And
yep.
He never really seemed to need him.
Yes.
Okay, changing conditions, we'll assume. I mean, you can excuse it away. And there are a few other things that are I don't say necessary contrivances and convenience. You know, the X-Men finding a ship that can be telepathically controlled, the Wasp finding one that she's somehow able to use, and things of that sort. You just got to kind of roll with it.
Yes, I guess my biggest part is, well, the conversation with Galactus is fairly simple.
Mm-hmm.
The explanation when he gets back begins to make less and less sense.
What part in particular bothered you?
Just the whole, okay, we're not going to fight. We're going to let Galactus assume this planet because I think that's what's best. And
yeah, I mean, I think Reed was kind of thinking himself into a deeper problem than he was in.
Yes.
It's like, well, you know, if we let Galactus and the Beyonder kind of duke it out, one of them will be gone and we've got one less problem to worry about. That's almost more of a supervillain plan than a superhero plan.
It is. And then Doom's solution is even less sensical in many ways.
Well, there's one part about Doom's escape from what they're still referring to as Doom Base, even though the heroes had taken it over, that I do have to call out because I found it just hilarious. Doom's escaped from his cell because he powered his suit back up because, well, he's Doom. He can do that. And he goes and he frees Claw.
Yep.
Claw is like, you narrate your life as you go along, don't you? Are you being taped?
Yes.
Why, yes. Every utterance of Doom must be recorded for posterity.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's kind of lampshading on the Doom is literally narrating a lot of this story for us because, well, we need that. But I did find it just kind of hilarious.
Well, yeah, but it's not unheard of.
Oh, and it's certainly not out of character.
Yeah, exactly. It's not out of character, nor is it not something we've seen in the real world.
Yeah, but the whole concept of there being a bunch of stenographers or something at Latveria who's transcribing all of this for the official record or something.
Yes.
Because you know some of it might need to get edited, and that would be, you know, who do you let do that?
Well, you know, that's when you end up in front of the Senate in the missing minutes.
Mm-hmm. I did think when Colossus was digging out the X-Men.
Yes.
That, again, was kind of almost a callback to issue 4 when the mountain got dropped on the heroes.
Yes, absolutely.
But this time we see it from kind of the other perspective, Thor's perspective, if you will. But this is where the X-Men and the heroes all kind of gather up at the village.
Yep.
We get a little bit more with Colossus and Johnny and the healer and that kind of whole quasi-love triangle. And then again, this is where Reed comes back and says, you know, maybe we should just, you know, let Galactus do his thing. But I also think this moment where we've got Cap kind of officially welcoming the X-Men as allies, including Magneto and stuff, you could argue this is a key moment in Marvel history.
Certainly.
You know, I think this is one of the first times that the X-Men and the Avengers have really officially teamed up, even though they're doing it off-planet and stuff, and certainly they're doing it for high stakes.
Yep.
I did think Doom's plan to use Claw to kind of carve him up into lenses was just kind of weird.
That continues the incomprehensible part.
I'll give a little bit of leeway for the crazy comic book pseudoscience. And we know Galactus has energy and we know Doom wants it.
Yes.
You know, we've seen him do that sort of power tapping before off Silver Surfer and whatnot, I believe.
Yep.
So to use Claw as some kind of mechanism for that, sure, why not, I guess. I don't understand it, but it makes as much sense as probably anything else they could have thought of.
Yep.
And I think it served a needed story point of having Claw sort of replace Ultron as Doom's right-hand man in this series.
Yes.
We get some fun stuff with the heroes and the X-Men kind of trying to fight Galactus and stuff. And then, of course, you know, Galactus escapes, at which point Reed finally tells the heroes, yeah, he doesn't need the machine to devour the planet. It just helps. It's like, dude, you should have mentioned that sooner.
Yep.
And then we've got Galactus devouring his ship to give him kind of the energy boost he needs. And then as he's getting ready to eat the planet and stuff, we've got Doom trying to steal his power. Thus ends the issue.
Yes, sort of. But yes.
The issue is to be continued. It doesn't end the story, of course.
That is true.
I mean, a ton happened in here. A lot of it focused around Galactus and kind of that imminent threat. And, you know, Reed's whole back and forth of what should he do, what should he not do. Again, like we were talking about earlier, that would have been its own almost side miniseries or one shot or something like that.
Okay. Well, yeah. But yeah, you've got that whole, that energy burst and yeah, and exactly. And Doom with the now and the sonic lenses, I guess, which don't make all that much sense, but okay.
Yeah. And what's weird is what we see here, and I think what we see in the next issue, the design of the whole contraption is fairly different.
It is. It's also odd that Reed walks in and instantly goes, oh yeah, that's what that is. And I go, how is that comprehensible to anyone?
Fair, but again, if you know Doom, and Reed definitely knows Doom,
yeah,
you've got to assume, what's he going to try to do? He's going to try to steal the power. So does this look like a machine that would steal the power? Yeah, it probably is. I think Hawkeye could have guessed that.
Fair enough.
So there was some fun stuff here. You know, we kind of glossed over Spider-Man discovering what his new costume could do with the web shooters, the short sleeves, that kind of stuff. But again, there's a lot of things that just in the course of a couple of panels or a page or something, you know, we get what would be an entire couple of page scene or whatever in a modern comic.
Okay.
So it's just a very different style of pacing of a comic book story. If we move on to that next issue, we pick up with, again, Galactus powering up and whatnot, but as he tries to power up, energy gets ripped away from it. And then the heroes decide, it's going towards Doom Base. Maybe we should find out what's going on.
Exactly.
They send Captain Marvel forward because she's, you know, able to turn into light and therefore travel at light speed. So the equivalent of a speedster, that kind of helps. It would have been nice if they'd kind of reminded us of that aspect of her powers and stuff early on when they were scoping out whatever base they originally had. Because again, I was kind of confused how they had scouted out, you know, 400 and some odd stories of this thing. Without Quicksilver or somebody around. We do get some interesting stuff with Doom when he first gets all of this power, because he's got almost omnipotence and just having a hard time controlling it.
Which is where it gets... This is where I begin to get lost.
Okay, how so?
He's omnipotent, essentially, at this point, right? Because he has drained Galactus's power.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've still got the confrontation upcoming with the Beyonder,
mm-hmm.
which arguably he wins and he gains all that power, but he's at the same point he was with just Galactus's power, or it's different, or it's not clear.
I agree that you would think once you've got one god's power, that would be enough for most people, but Doom is not most people.
No, and I understand that, but there is no noticeable difference, at least not that's explained clearly, between one's power and the other's power. And if does Doom need the second one, or could he do everything he does after he has the second one with just the first? And if Doom can do all this with Galactus's power, why couldn't Galactus do all that with Galactus?
One argument could be made that Galactus uses his powers based on his own kind of preconceived notion, and he's not kind of the power-hungry, power-mad person that Doom is.
Okay.
But I agree with your point that here he's got the, you know, I could transform the world with a stray thought, I must gain control kind of a thing, which is something he struggles with once he gets the Beyonder's power as well in a little bit. So it is unclear if Galactus is on the same level as the Beyonder, or once you get past a certain level to a human mind, almost kind of doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But again, that's where it gets confusing, because Doom seems to be all-powerful and trying to deal with that here,
mm-hmm.
and then he deals with the Beyonder and gets more power and pretty much is in the same spot.
Well, it's interesting because some of the stuff we see here, a lot of it was more around sensory-type stuff, but he had also shown some definite power-level stuff, like when he basically forces Captain Marvel into almost a living hologram state.
Yep.
So that's more than just he can sense everything. And you could have argued that if it was Galactus, it's, yeah, he's got some innate power, but it's the sensory stuff that made him so weird or so, you know, godlike or whatever. But then when you get to Beyonder, that's when he can actually change things. But clearly that's not the case. He's got these abilities now.
Yeah.
But he's, I think it may be as much that he doesn't want the Beyonder to also have this level of power. He wants to be the only one with it.
Sure.
I think there's some things they could have done to have clarified that.
Exactly.
So we've got the heroes kind of rushing off to Doom Base in their derelict ship or whatever that Magneto is basically, you know, flying through his magnetic powers and stuff. And it's funny because they seem to be pretty impressed with it, and it seemed to be taking a fair amount of Magneto's powers, whereas this seems to be the sort of thing that today he would do without a second thought. If Magneto's fully powered up, there are times he's not at his full strength, and it would be more of a challenge, certainly.
Yeah.
And while they're flying, we've got time for a little bit of a back and forth between Cap and Wolverine on the plight of the mutants and mutant rights and such. And I'm like, come on, this is Cap. He's for everybody. I did think it was kind of funny where right before the heroes crash into the base, Doom restructures his armor to conceal his secret weapon against the Beyonder in his revised armor. And of course, this armor looks exactly like the action figure does.
Yeah, well, of course.
And it's funny because it's not that different than his standard look. You just ditch the cape and make it much more high tech than kind of medieval. The color scheme is the same, and the overall design, like I said, not radically different.
Yep.
So the heroes crash in, they discover Ms. Marvel. We then get to the point where Reed discovers the power-absorbing device type stuff. Like, yeah, he gets that in a single guess. And yeah, from here, things just start to get rather kind of chaotic just because so much is happening so quickly. You know, the planet quakes, suddenly it seems like half the heroes are down. But really, keeping this many characters in play at any one time is rough.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and then we get the bit where in a monitor, on one of the monitors in the base, Colossus sees the healer is hurt. He tells Johnny. Johnny's not having, you know, doesn't really care because, well, Reed's hurt. That, of course, sets Colossus off. That kind of kicks that part of the love triangle storyline forward. And we get this great shot from kind of in space where we're seeing kind of the after effect or whatever, the impact, if you will, of the battle between the Beyonder and Doom, where I think they phrased that the sun this planet's orbiting was almost blown out like a candle.
Yes, it's exactly like a birthday candle, I believe.
Yeah, so they definitely give some good dialogue and stuff there, and may really see Doom in that realm of the Beyonder fighting his hardest, but man, he is literally getting cut to pieces.
Sort of.
I wouldn't say sort of. If you look at that first thing, he loses a leg early on.
He does, but all of it seems to be this ploy to just get the Beyonder close enough.
I think it was more than just a ploy. I think he was struggling at this point.
Okay.
There's a line of all my power is not enough, etc., etc. And even with all of Galactus's stuff, which shouldn't surprise us because we'd already seen Galactus kind of get swatted away by the Beyonder earlier in the series.
Yes.
So to me, that does a little bit towards explaining your question of, well, why did Doom want even more power? Because it was clearly more power.
Yeah.
Doom does have enough time and energy and concentration to send a hologram down to the planet to the heroes saying, hey, anyone want to help me out? And it's like, yeah, this is the wrong group to do that with. Go do that with the villains. But Magneto was starting to take him up on the offer, starting to think about it and not do it. And then, man, he gets tackled by Hawkeye, Iron Man, and Wasp. But what I found interesting is instead of that kind of escalating the situation and Magneto storming off or whatever, Cap really steps up to sort of his defense, saying, hey, we were all tempted, and yeah, he was starting to go for it, but we could see he was stopping. You didn't have to tackle. And then we get to the point where Doom is both seeing his life flash before him, but more importantly, the Beyonder is seeing Doom's life flash before him. One of the many ways we've gotten some flashbacks into this. And then that probing awakens Doom enough to apparently trigger whatever he had in his armor, which again was conveniently never explained or whatever, but presumably that's how he gets the Beyonder's powers. And at this point, Doombase is just falling down. Cap, of course, stays to free the villains because, well, it's the humane thing to do. And Wolverine comes in to help, gives them a nice kind of bonding moment or whatnot. And once everyone is clear of the wreckage of that, this big ball of light comes down. And, you know, they're wondering, well, what is it? And out comes this, geez, I don't know, 200-foot-tall Doom?
Yes.
I mean, this is the Make My Monster Grow part of the Power Rangers story. And then, of course, they're like, well, what are we going to do? And Doom just conveniently shrinks down to more human size, saying, oh, I have everything under control. The war is over as he's taking off his face mask, which is, again, a very un-Doom-like thing to do, given his vanity and the facial scars he's had. So we had quite a bit going on. I would say this one was very Doom-focused around getting Galactus's power and then getting the Beyonder's power. But I don't think it would have taken much to kick a what-if story on a different trajectory. You know, what if Doom hadn't awakened and gotten the Beyonder's power? You know, what would have happened next or something?
Yeah, well, I mean, arguably, from this point forward, this whole thing's a Doom story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is definitely a turning point in the story, and this whole last quarter of it really focuses around not, you know, can we deal with the Beyonder or not, but can we deal with Doom and all of that?
Yep.
Which isn't too surprising, because again, he was initially set up as the power player among the villains. I mean, there was Galactus, but he was more as kind of that wild card or whatever. Doom was the one bossing everybody around, and you knew was in charge and the threat to deal with in that group.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So if we go from there, we pick up right on the heels of that in issue 11, where we see Doom's fully healed face and him declaring that the Beyonder's dead and, oh yeah, I have his power. What I thought was really interesting was as the heroes are reacting to that, we get kind of a cutaway to the villains who were, you know, not that far away, having just been freed from Doombase. And they're like, hey, Doom's selling us out. What I found interesting at this point was this is where we really start to get Absorbing Man and Titania being very friendly. Whereas they'd interacted before, but it was, I think it was a different tone to that interaction. And this is, again, setting the stage for kind of the long-term trajectory of those two over the future decades, where I don't remember if they actually get married or not, but they essentially, you know, act like a married couple from about this point forward. What I did find also kind of surprising is Molecule Man basically getting a bit of a backbone here and going after Doom.
Yeah, but ultimately that's a terrible idea too.
Out of all the villains to do it, I would say he's the only one who had a shot. I'm still not saying it's a good idea, but I can, if it would been like Doc Ock or something, it's like, yeah, the guy's toast, forget it, even without the Galactus and Beyonder powers. Molecule Man at least has the power to do it. He just never had the backbone to do it. And I don't really feel that they kind of earned that part of the story here. It just felt a little out of the blue.
Yeah. I mean, he felt betrayed, but ultimately the story kind of takes care of itself in these few pages. He's like, wait a minute, I thought I was so important to Doom's plans, yada, yada, yada. And then he tries to attack Doom, but Doom doesn't just squash him. He goes, wait a minute, you really do have all this power, and kind of like shows him what he could do.
Mm-hmm.
Which, then, you know, so even in like these two or three pages, it's a whole story and it makes sense.
Well, and it's another one of those whole stories that I think today would have been its own one-shot or miniseries.
Yeah.
I don't know what they would have titled it or whatever, but you're right. Within these two or three pages, we've got a massive status quo change for Molecule Man, from getting the backbone to stand up for himself through the enlightenment he gets through Doom. And now, not only does he have all of this power and he can now do stuff with organic molecules, which he didn't think he could do before, but his willingness and ability to use that power,
yep,
is now on a level it just hadn't been. And of course, he then says, hey, I'm taking over and being the leader and such. So what I found hilarious is, hey, we need food and shelter. And Volcano's like, hey, we can go to my place. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's part of that suburb of Denver that is somewhere on Battle World.
Yep.
And granted, I don't think there are that many places like Doombase just lying around waiting to be used, but heading to somebody's apartment just felt a little funny.
But they did all seem, you've got Doom, okay, I'm all powerful. Molecule Man, you take over the rest of the bad guys, you guys go your way, and they go to you know, that suburb of Denver, and the hero's kind of, okay, we're all going back to Doom Base. Yeah, it's a weird little parting.
Well, the reason the heroes are going back to Doom Base is because Molecule Man just about threw them into space.
Just about, but again, they've got to go someplace. I'm surprised they chose there as opposed to the village they'd been at.
Yeah, it does seem a little odd, but I guess they had already kind of set that up as their base of operations after they'd taken it over from the villains, as to why they're not being a little more protective of the villagers, and if so, why only that village versus all the others that are probably on this planet? I mean, they know a suburb of Denver is here, and they really haven't even gone to go check it out.
Nope, yep.
So I thought that was a little odd. And I loved the bit when they get back to Doom Base of, well, let's go over what we know. Cue flashback.
And they recap everything, yes.
And this is the kind of thing that we get it periodically. A different character may kick it off or whatever, but this was the sort of thing that was done routinely in this era of comic book storytelling in place of today's previously on kind of recap cheat sheet page outside of the story.
Yep.
And I prefer it done in the story myself.
Well, and we're used to them, and it made them accessible, and yeah, no, there were lots of things I like about that style, but yes.
Now, I'm curious what Volcana did for a living prior to Secret Wars, because she's got her own apartment, okay, no big deal, but how big is this apartment? It's able to reasonably comfortably fit 11 villains.
It doesn't appear that large to me.
Well, that's my point. It doesn't, yet they're not tripping all over themselves all the time.
It appears to be a one, possibly two-bedroom apartment with a semi-large living room.
Yeah, the living room's large enough that, again, it can fit all 11 of them. It looks like it only has a single bathroom, definitely.
Yeah, and again, you can say fits all of them, but, you know, you've got five people basically sitting on one couch, and, you know, the Wrecking Crew is kind of scrunched in there, and Enchantress is on an arm, and...
They were all physically in the room, and one or two of these people...
No one's in a fold-up chair.
I mean, Absorbing Man's not tiny by any stretch. He's pretty big and muscular. The arms for Doc Ock take up a bit of room.
Yeah.
You know, it just seemed like in some places, getting that many people in one place, you know, in that kind of a room, would have been tough.
Yeah.
The part I find funniest about it is that seemed to be the best shelter they could get out of this suburb of Denver. There's no bar or club or restaurant to take over. There's nothing. So.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
Not saying it was a bad choice. It just was, it struck me as odd.
This is also an interesting and weird part of Battleworld, because that kind of that establishing shot, mm-hmm. You see what very much looks like, oh, here's a couple blocks, here's a couple blocks of this, whereas previously we have seen vast stretches that are the same, yet this one there's like five or six little patches just in this little area.
Yeah, this seems to be a much tighter patchwork area than the ones where you could fly over it for hours and still be in this alien environment.
Exactly.
This is one where when they did the more recent Secret War, they took a very kind of different approach to Battle World with very clear boundaries between the sections and whatnot. And actually, I kind of like the newer Battle World quite a bit. I thought it was a clever idea. This is one where I thought the idea was good. It just never really got explored.
No, it didn't.
I mean, you could almost do a series inside of these 12 issues, or the time frame of these 12 issues, where you've got like a squad of SHIELD soldiers, you know, exploring Battle World, going from, you know, patchwork area to patchwork area, or AIM scientists looting it for whatever science they can discover in the difference. You know, and I would think if you were to tell this story today, it wouldn't surprise me if we had either or both of those kinds of miniseries going on.
Well, again, with the newer one, we had, what, 16 miniseries going on?
At least, but each one was kind of inside of a particular realm of Battle World.
Yes.
Versus somebody just exploring all of Battle. Although there may have been one of those two. I don't remember. It's been a few years. When Molecule Man decides to go all Argo City on this chunk of Denver, I thought that was kind of funny. He just pops a dome on it and says, hey, we're going home. And thus exits the villains for the most part, although we don't totally ignore them after this. I don't remember that chunk of Denver kind of landing back on Earth and that being any sort of a big deal at the time. So another missed opportunity for a story. The heroes notice that and they're like, yeah, well, they're going to do what they're going to do.
Yes.
I think this might be... No, I don't think this... Somewhere we got a thing of Reed saying, I think I've got a way to get us home, but it wasn't at this point.
It was not, but yes, no, there is a point where they're like, well, how do we get home? And Reed's like, oh, I can figure that out.
Yeah.
We got this whole other problem. We have to deal with Doom.
Mm-hmm. We get a page where Colossus is pining over the healer, so he darts out on like one of these sky jet ski kind of a things, While he's going out, a bolt of energy is flying in and kind of zaps the Hulk, who then goes sleepwalking, encounters a Spider-Woman who tries to stop him, pretty much fails, and then the energy goes from Hulk to Spider-Woman, and then she kind of is about to head out. But then a flash of light happens. And then apparently, in that flash of light, Doom came in and did some stuff. I think he fixed Captain Marvel. She's now, you know, not in her light form. And left.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
See, I'm not sure that's Doom.
Well, given the bolt of energy was not, but this flash of light was.
Oh, yes. Okay, fair enough.
Because on that next page, we've got the engraved invitation.
Yep.
And they are summoned to the Tower of Doom at dusk tomorrow.
Well, and here's the other thing. You clearly see Colossus trying to sleep, Cap's asleep. What I find most interesting here is when Spider-Woman walks in, the claw lens device is still there.
Yeah.
Claw's head is still, like, sitting on the table, sentient. So for all the do-gooding of the heroes to help the villains escape and stuff when it was all falling apart, no one said, hey, maybe we should let Claw put himself back together. That they just left.
Oh, and Claw didn't even seem to try.
Well, he didn't, but he was clearly sentient because he was talking to him and everything else. And, you know, neither Cap nor Reed nor everyone went, you know, we should probably take all those parts, let him see if he can put himself back together.
Well, according to the caption, Claw is sleeping at this point.
At this
point. But yeah, he'd been talking at other points. The fact that he had
been talking to the heroes at other points, and they had done nothing for him.
Well, they'd done nothing for him, and he'd done nothing for himself.
Well, yes.
The fact they left the machine there almost begs the question of, did they think they might need to use it?
Or why? Or yeah, it's just weird.
Again, in a modern version of this story, I think we would have had a lengthy scene with them debating, do we dismantle the thing? We might need it. Let's hold our options open. If we use it, who would use it? What would happen? And that could be a fun thing to watch.
It could be. But even on the more basic level of, again, Cap went into the falling apart building to make sure all the villains got out of the cells. Mm-hmm. But he didn't go, hey, Claw, there's pieces of you all over this room. Let me collect them. That he didn't bother. He went to bed instead of doing that.
Well, and even if Cap didn't, Reed didn't, and a few of the others. So
exactly.
Yeah, for all of the, Reed is such a humanitarian, not helping him. Yeah, it does seem a little odd. I did find it interesting when they're like, well, what's this Tower of Doom? What's he talking about? And they look out the window, and it must be that giant thing that's, you know, out 200 miles high that we hadn't noticed before.
Yes. What's the Tower of Doom? Well, it's that giant tower.
Well,
like, enough.
Why wait until dusk tomorrow? It's not like Doom needed time to set stuff up. He just built the tower already.
He was being considerate and giving them time to rest.
All right. Here's a question for you.
Yep.
And I guess it's got a clear explanation and answers your question of why the heroes didn't do anything for Claw. Spider-Woman goes by. We see Claw's head. He's asleep. We get the flash of light. That's when Doom comes and goes.
Mm-hmm.
We then get the, oh, that's the Tower of Doom. At that moment, deep inside the foreboding tower, is Doom talking to Claw?
Yes.
So apparently Doom darted by, picked up Claw, and put them all back together.
Yes, no doubt about it. But that's my point. The shot of Spider-Woman walking in clearly shows the machine still there, so all of Claw's pieces separated. And then his head sitting on the table, resting. And then comes Doom. Doom's the only one that goes, oh, I should put this guy back together and you restore him. The heroes don't.
Well, and other than Doom liking to have a lackey around, I can't think of a reason why he did that.
Well, okay, fair enough. But, you know, if you're Claw, Doom treated you a lot better than the heroes did.
Oh, absolutely. And not just here. I mean, he got blasted to pieces by Dazzler. So I could see where Claw is upset with heroes just on a general standpoint.
It works out. And again, after that several pages of Cap making such a big deal about saving the heroes just in the last book.
Mm-hmm.
Saving the villain, sorry.
Well, again, some of that is for dramatic effect, and at other points, there's so much going on in this story that plot points kind of get dropped, kind of get glossed over. Like, again, why didn't they do anything for Claw? Whereas before, oh, Enchantress was hurt, they're so good, they're putting her in a healing thing.
Yep.
You know, they'd already beat that drum a couple of times, they didn't need to do it again, I guess. So, yeah, definitely interesting point that I hadn't caught the first time, so good to point that out. We get a little bit of a tour of the throne room, and Doom mentioning that he dare not sleep lest the power go out of control, as he then goes to lie down. It's like, if you don't want to sleep, maybe don't lie down, just saying. We then get Colossus going to the healer, professing his love, and Wolverine and Nightcrawler saying, oh, that's not going to end well for anybody. And then, actually, at that point, we jumped 18 hours forward. It's now dusk the next day. It's time to go visit Doom at his tower.
Yep.
So they all fly over there, and I guess another ship they'd found, get in there, introduce by Claw, and Doom is just so magnanimous. He's like, well, I gotta make right past wrong, so let me put Kang back together again and go teleport him home to his time frame. We get a line of dialogue saying, oh yeah, Galactus, who's just floating in space, he's fine. One of his heralds got him. He's good. Don't worry about that. So, I mean, there are a couple of things with just a line of dialogue, certain threads of the story just, I don't say get resolved, but get dealt with.
Yes.
At least get excused from the story. How about that? We get a thought balloon telling us, something's wrong with Spider-Woman. Of course, we'd seen the bolt of energy, so we kind of know what's going on there. And then basically, Doom is offering the heroes a boon, kind of in place of the Beyonder, and they're like, yeah, we don't need anything. We're good. I think this is where Reed is saying, oh, don't worry about it. I can get us home. We don't need that from Doom. It's funny. The things they're thinking about asking for is getting home, finding Lockheed. And I really don't think there was much of anything else they even contemplated asking for.
Nope.
But it was a good reminder that we hadn't seen Lockheed for really most of the series.
Yes.
I think we lost sight of him around issue 3 or 4, maybe. Maybe even 2. So all the heroes file out of the Tower of Doom. Cap, of course, does a head count, gets to 20, realizes there ought to be 21, heads back in for Spider-Woman. And this was just kind of funny, because at this point, Doom, who the heroes have just left, has already taken off his armor, is kicking his heels up on his table and just chilling out. This is a much more relaxed Victor Von Doom than we usually get.
Yes.
Have a nice chat between him and Cap, where it's like, oh yeah, I gotta do something for my mom, who's dead, the captive of Mephisto or whatever, while Claw is looking for Spider-Woman, quickly finds her, and the energy goes from her into Claw, as again Cap and Doom continue to talk. Not that Doom feels threatened, but he's put his armor back on. I thought that was kind of interesting. So Claw comes back, Cap finds Spider-Woman, they head out. We get a quick cut to the romance between Colossus and the healer. It's, of course, setting up the is Colossus going to want to go home or not. And then they've apparently found a council chamber at Doom Base that we had yet to see in the series, with a table big enough for almost all of the heroes.
Well, assuming we've only, you know, seen 2 or 3 of the 480-some floors we know exist.
Yeah, certainly there's room for it. I'm just wondering how they found it. And the fact that it doesn't have room for everybody, because Magneto, Hulk, and Thing are kind of standing around, which doesn't surprise me too much. Hulk and Thing, it would have been hard to find just chairs for them to begin with. But I did find it telling that Cap is like, you know, if Doom has really transcended the way he says he has, why is he hanging around and going to be going and doing stuff for his mom and stuff like this? Is he really as transcended as he thinks he is? You know, if one of the first things you do is repair the scars on your face, you're still human to some degree. And the heroes pretty much quickly decide that, yeah, they got to stay and deal with Doom.
Which is still odd.
Why do you think that's odd? He's got godlike power and not the type you would trust with it.
I understand that. But the big fear, as stated here, is that he will free a human soul from a demon.
That's the first thing he's going to do.
Yes. Like, we can't allow that. Really? We're siding with demons. We hate Doom so much, we're siding with demons now.
That isn't how I read it. It's not that they're siding with demons and stuff. They might even have gotten behind that aspect. Matter of fact, Cap saying, seems humane, he'd even almost volunteer for that.
Yeah.
But if it's a human desire, what happens after that? And it's that next step that they're worried about.
Yeah, like I said, they try to articulate it, but there's aspects of the way they articulate it that don't make a lot of sense.
It gets down to, this needs to be a unanimous decision, and I think part of the articulation that I found most telling was, you know, it's all down to Colossus. And Cap's like, keep in mind, if we decide to confront him, it's possible we might be annihilated on the spot by a bolt from the blue. Because, you know, he's got godlike powers, and he could do that. So, after a little agonizing, if he just wants to be with his one true love, Colossus says, you know what, I'm being selfish, got to do this. End on a splash page of a bolt from the blue, or maybe it's red or yellow, take your pick, annihilating all the heroes. So Cap was right. That, of course, making a fairly dramatic, shocking ending. Perhaps it would have been more shocking if we hadn't already been reading these characters having survived the story, you know, for the last year as it was being published. But I'll be honest, when I was reading through it, I got to this point and said, you know what, it's time for a break, because this next issue, this final issue, it's what, 40-some-odd pages long.
It is. It is lengthy.
And already so much had been happening at this point. I'm like, hell, if everybody's dead, this is a good stop to point to pause reading.
Yes.
And man, this last issue did not disappoint in terms of just a mountain of things happening.
Is that? That is true.
I think they fell into a couple of categories. One, oversized final issue spectacular, you know, big action adventure, gotta have that. Some of it is the, oh crap, this is the final issue. There's a couple of things we gotta do because we already established them as having happened, you know, 11 months or so back. And just a couple of things that, you know, fall somewhere in between. When we start this issue, we confirm that all 21 heroes lie dead, struck down by a bolt from the blue. Like, okay, I interpreted that last scene correctly, I guess. Okay. What I found interesting is then they start listing them all off, or at least almost all of them off. They only get to 20.
This is where it gets odd. We've got a narrator who clearly tells us they're all dead. We've got Doom, an omniscient being, who tells us they're all dead. And then the rest of what happens.
I think at this point they are all dead.
Okay.
Because, I mean, we see the debris, we see bits of costume, or at least a gauntlet, I guess. We see Cap's shield pretty well toasted. And then when we get to Doom's tower and stuff, we've got Claw talking to him, and, you know, Doom is pulling back in the power, having clearly been the one to obliterate them.
Yep.
And Claw starts telling a story of, well, you know, maybe they're not so dead.
Yes.
Now, before we get to that, we get a quick cutaway to that chunk of Denver flying back to Earth, and everybody's still hanging out in Volcano's apartment. And I gotta think, in a 6-square-mile chunk of Denver, had to be better accommodations, but okay. And I thought it was funny that at this point, Enchantress summons a water elemental to learn more about the Beyond. You couldn't have done that like 10, 11 issues ago when it would have really helped?
This is about three, four pages into the issue. This is where we get the recap of the series.
Yep.
It's where it always happens.
But the excuse for the recap of let me learn more about the Beyonder?
Sure, why not?
It took her this long to think of it. And she also powers up the water elemental almost by boiling it or whatever to go find out what's happening on the battle world planet so she can recap the stuff that the villains have missed.
Yes.
So full service recap here. Again, needed. Again, in this day and age, absolutely would not happen. The assumption would be, hey, we're 12 issues in. If you don't know what's going on, we're not going to tell you. Now, maybe they'd have the previously on page that would cover some of this, but a lot of cases they don't. And this is where the size of this apartment starts to get even more curious. Lizard starts to freak out. He's just, I think, getting a little cabin fever. Volcana blasts some stuff. And there's a fair amount of room for this fight to be happening in this without, like, vaporizing the couch and the TV and all those sorts of things.
Well, you do see some chairs and a stool turned over. And
yeah, there's some of that, but the fact that there was room for the fight in and of itself surprised me.
Well, and then really when there's any kind of actual fight starting, you know, Doc Ock instantly takes a wall out to give them more space.
Well, and this is where Molecule Man just kind of appears back in and tries to take over, take control of the situation and whatnot. And man, Doc Ock is just getting in his face. Which, earlier in the series, okay, I could see that. At this point where we've seen what Molecule Man not only can, but is willing to do at this point, kind of gutsy for Doc Ock to do that.
Well, and he pays for it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is also where Enchantress kind of enchants Volcana for her purposes. She's decided she wants to fast track it to home, but to do that, she needs a little more power. And you know what? A life force will do just fine for that. Meanwhile, while that's starting to go on, the villains have gone outside, and Molecule Man is showing them the stars. At which point they remember, wait a sec, there were no stars. Those got wiped out back in issue one. And we're really starting to see just how much power Molecule Man has, and that he's starting to learn how to do space warps so they can get home a little faster. So this, to me, is where they really powered up the character significantly, and he was already crazy powerful. And since Volcana had helped Lizard, Lizard helps her by letting Molecule Man know that Enchantress has taken her. And right before Enchantress is about to teleport to Earth, Molecule Man and Lizard show up, and she's like, okay, I can't make it to Earth. Where can I get to? She heads back to Battle World, but Lizard jumps in at just the wrong time and takes the trip with her. So it seemed like the whole point of this was to get these two characters back to Battle World, even though they'd already taken off. And I don't know that we see the villains again after this. But we get a very interesting exchange between Lizard and Enchantress. The Lizard slashes her face She is not happy about it, and she pretty much vaporizes him to get his life force to heal herself. This, of course, is going to come into play. Not of course, but this does come into play later in the issue with another thing that happens. But this is where we start to get Claw under the control of the energy force we'd seen last issue, starting to make a move on Doom, but Doom wakes up having nearly fallen asleep, chastises Claw, "If you shouldn't let me do that." And this is where Claw starts spinning that tale of what happened to the heroes.
Okay, this is where it gets confusing, but yes.
Yeah, because at this point, it's unclear how much is Claw in control and how much is he being controlled by the energy thing, which, no surprise, turns out to be the Beyonder.
Yes, but yeah, the question is he recounting a story or is he creating it?
I think he's creating it.
I agree.
And he's using 3D images to give us essentially a recap of events that we haven't seen to plant them in the mind of Doom, who's got just a loose enough control of his power that these things can actually happen if you convince them they have happened.
Yes.
Now, the whole bit of the healer checking in on the heroes after seeing the bolt, finding Colossus, who had armored up and was the sturdiest among them, which I question. These days, it probably would have been the Hulk that would have been that. You could argue Thor. Anyways, she goes to Colossus, heals him like she had healed Wasp. That pretty much kills her off. But Colossus is then in turn able to save Mr. Fantastic, whose elastic structure had helped him survive to some degree through a healing chamber that Colossus magically figures out. Reed is healed. The two of them heal everybody else from the dead, which is pretty impressive machinery for Battleworld to have.
Yes.
And of course, Doom's like, "Oh, this couldn't possibly happen, would it?" And all of this is Claw planting the seeds for all of this, and that maybe secretly, subconsciously, Doom wanted them to live so they can live. And this is, to me, the Beyonder using Claw as a puppet to use Doom's possession of the Beyonder power to make all this stuff happen.
Yes.
And given the cliffhanger ending we had of everybody getting vaporized, we knew something of this sort had to happen. You can't have the heroes make it back to Earth if they're dead. It just doesn't work. So I thought this was some good interplay between Claw and Doom to kind of make all of that sort of thing happen. And as Doom's wondering, it couldn't possibly be, in comes Thor's hammer crashing into the Tower of Doom, showing, yes, it really did happen. But chicken and egg, again, I choose to believe that Doom made this happen because Claw had manipulated him, because Beyonder had manipulated him. And then we get this shot of the planet just going nuts from Doom letting loose of the power. And what's interesting is at this point, he can't control it, so he gives a portion of it to Claw. And at this point, all we seem to be talking about is the Beyonder's power, having lost track of whatever happened to Galactus's power.
Yes.
I mean, we know Galactus is okay, but he's still powerless. I don't know if they ever really kind of closed the loop on that storyline or not.
Not in this, in these issues.
Certainly not in these issues. A lot was left, I don't say unresolved, but implied that it would happen off panel. We get a nice shot of the heroes, you know, launching into battle against Doom as they get to the tower, only to be met up by these giant monsters that Claw is just creating. Used to be they would just be like holograms or whatever, but now he can actually make them real because he's got a slice of the power. And we get some, I don't say Kirby-ish monsters, but definitely iconic Marvel-style monsters, we'll say. You know, flying fish, almost a techno, I don't know, dragon bat sort of thing and whatnot. It's cool-looking visuals for a nice two-page splash. And we hadn't gotten too many two-page splashes in this series. Matter of fact, I'm trying to think if we'd gotten any before.
We had.
The Dropping of the Mountain, maybe?
There's a few.
Okay.
I'm reading it digitally, so I tend to notice them more.
Ah.
They pop up not quite once an issue. There's probably 8 to 10 in the whole series.
Well, and this is one where it's all action, no dialogue.
Yep.
Which is, again, cool. What surprised me is we've only got, I don't know, 8 or 9 of the heroes in this, maybe more, maybe a dozen, but there's like half of them left out. And of course, as the thing is battling one of these monsters, a smaller one, of course, he turns into Ben. He's like, nope, can't do that, and is able to revert back into the thing under his own control, which of course, very emotional moment for him. We get Hulk doing some serious damage on Ultron, who then does some serious damage on the Hulk, severely injuring his leg, before Ultron just kind of almost disassembles thanks to the Wasp having gotten inside and yanking wires.
Yes.
I think there's more to it than that, but okay. So just a ton of action going on here with Cap managing to slip by Claw, which basically means Claw, let him get by, so Cap could go confront Doom.
Which then leads to that, which is kind of the big face-off of the issue.
Yeah, this is definitely a moment that a variant of it gets replayed in, I think it was Secret Wars 3. Cap is going up against Doom. Doom has the power, and he just vaporizes Cap. Cap then springs miraculously back to life. Doom vaporizes again. Cap pops back up. Comes back, and this is basically, is Doom sowing the seeds of his own defeat by resurrecting Cap, or maybe Claw's doing it. Either way, it's happening, and it does not go well for Doom, because at this point, Cap starts to realize Doom's struggling to control all this power, which is not meant to be in human hands, and that by winning this fight with Doom, he may lose the bigger battle, and the universe could pay the price. So he offers to kind of be the anchor Doom needs to reality and such. But at this point, the energy pops out of Claw back into this kind of melee or whatever, grabbing the stolen power, and, you know, the Beyonder, I don't say is reborn, but is I guess, re-whatever it was he was, re-Beyonderized.
Well, it specifically says reclaims his, you know, savage suddenness. The Beyonder reclaims his power.
Right. Right. I was not debating whether he reclaimed the power. I was debating the reborn terminology because he's
fair
not
enough
human. So re-Beyonderized, I think, is what I'm going to go with.
Fair enough.
What's interesting at this point is the Beyonder, Doom, and Claw just kind of teleport away. And this goes back to like when Doom, or not Doom, when Galactus and Reed and all that just kind of popped away. Sometimes things just happen and a change of venue is needed.
Well, at this point, you can argue it's the Beyonder. He did this to bring them here. Why can't he do this to put them back?
Yeah, the question is he putting them back at this point? And the other thing that happened here is between those panels, when the Beyonder's got his power back, Doom's in his high-tech armor, and then on the next page, he's back to how he was before in the old style armor.
Yes.
So at some point, and I know a later story addressed this as to when was Doom taken from and put back to kind of close the loop on his lifeline, if you will. And that was back when they actually cared about such things in continuity. But at this point, it's like, hey, they've won. Claw's creatures are gone. They go, they bury the healer, and it's a matter of wrapping a couple of things up before they go home.
Yep.
Reed needs a little bit to prep the way home, so they get some stuff to eat. Some of the heroes get some new costumes. We see, I think, the Wasp's new costume. I'm trying to think if that's a new one for Rogue. Certainly, Professor X's yellow costume with the black X is new. And this is where it starts to dawn on Spidey that they're using a different machine, and their suits don't respond to their thoughts like his does. And he's like, oh, well, whatever. Yeah, that's going to come back to haunt him. And then we've also got the Hulk unable to be healed through one of the healing machines because of his gamma levels or whatever. So Reed puts together a crutch and a brace for him. Again, these days, the Hulk's healing is such that I don't think they would have needed to do this, but earlier point in the character. And I think this is also where She-Hulk gets her Fantastic Four costume. Is she wearing one later? Yeah, she is. That's where she got it. Okay. The part that I found just hilarious is Hawkeye finally has new arrows because Reed finally got around to showing him how the fabrication machine worked. He'd been carving arrows throughout this entire series. Now he's got some legit ones.
Well, it holds. You know, he was carving them throughout the whole series, still kind of mildly miffed that Reed had taken them all from him when they were under the mountain.
Yeah, but the fact that he didn't ask anybody else for help? I mean, he'd seen a couple of people. I'm trying to think, who was it with Thor when Thor had gotten his new costume back around issue 8?
The Hulk.
Okay, so it was the Hulk. So I was going to say, it would have been really funny if it had been Hawkeye at that point. And then at this point, Kurt Connors comes walking into Doom Base. He's human now. He doesn't know what happened, but the lizard stuff was sucked out of him. To me, this was, again, we saw the lizard get kind of vaporized by the Enchantress. This is one of those, hey, we've got to put stuff back. We'd had Connors human when Spidey came out of the arena or whatever back 11 months ago. We got to go address that now. So they just kind of, I don't say shoehorn that in, but it felt a little wavy hands for Doc Connors to be okay, given what had happened to the lizard.
A lot of this stuff does.
Oh, yeah.
The machine that magically fixes Cap's shield seems a little odd, too.
That's not actually a machine. At this point, there is a theory Reed's got of a wish fulfillment energy kind of lingering on the planet after the battle Doom had against the Beyonder.
Okay.
So this is why Kurt just shows up. This is why Lockheed just shows up. Why things just happen to be working.
Yeah.
So Cap says, if that's the case, he's somehow gone and collected every shard of his shield out of that debris, which we never see, but okay, whatever. Maybe that was, actually, I don't know when that would have been.
Well, when Claw was telling the story, it was somewhere in there.
Yeah, not knowing when they got resurrected and all of that timeline, it must have been between resurrection and going and attacking. But he's gotten all the pieces, and he wills the shield back together.
Yes.
So no machine is involved. He's actively using that wish fulfillment energy.
Kind of. There's no machine involved, but the machine that's... It seems like he pulls out a panel of the machine they were using for the costumes and stuff and setting it all there when he makes the wish. So it's not as clear.
He sets it on a table and...
Table? Again, it seems to be an extension of one of those machines.
Look at that. That the caption in that one, later alone in his dimly lit chamber, Captain America carefully arranges the shards of his legendary shield on his table.
It says table, but again, if you look at it.
I agree. It doesn't look like a standard table and stuff, but it flat out says it's in his chamber, not in the one where the costume stuff was.
Fair enough.
And then the final one is nothing could fix it unless by sheer force of will or sheer desire.
Yeah, no, and then he can accomplish the impossible.
Exactly. Yeah. So I took it as no machine was needed. He was just able to tap into the latent magic energy on the planet, which I would think if this were happening in a modern comic, we would have seen some sort of humorous usage of this sort of effect by Johnny or somebody else a little more whimsical. Suddenly he's got his Lamborghini or, you know, whatever. But outside the fortress after this, Reed is... This is where things got a little confusing for me, because he's put together some kind of a device that Reed's using to beam up everybody to the construct, which will teleport to Earth with them in it, and then land in Central Park and they'll get out. But then as he's beaming the groups up, it's as if they're just getting home automatically at that
point. We don't necessarily know that because we never see where they end up.
Well, that's true. But to me, the fact that when Lockheed's friend goes in as Reed hits the button for the X-Men and there's the energy thing.
And it all like looks like it explodes. He goes, that was dramatic, but they're okay, I hope. And they just kind of move on.
Well, specifically he says, I hope it doesn't cause problems with their rematerialization back on Earth.
Yes.
At that point, it's as if they're beaming straight home. And I don't recall if there was any kind of fallout from that or not. There may have been. It's been, I don't know, 35 years or whatever since this came out? So it's been that long since I read it?
Yep.
And we did get a moment of Colossus wondering, should I stay or should I go? And he decides to go back.
Yep.
Because, of course, the healer is dead. There's no point for him to stay.
And then you get the whole Ben thing.
Yeah, Ben announces She-Hulk's going to take his place and that he's staying and he can control his changing back and forth. And there's a thought balloon Reed has of, he has a theory as to why he can turn back and forth, but he hopes Ben never learns the truth.
Yep.
Or he slowly discovers it or it hides from him forever or whatever. I wasn't entirely sure what to make of that. And I know it did get addressed later in the Thing series. I just don't remember what it was. But yeah, Ben beams the rest of the Fantastic Four up because they've already beamed up the Avengers.
Well, that's the thing. Ultimately, you need someone last person to stay and push the last button.
I'm not so sure. I don't see why they couldn't have taken the device with them. And even if they couldn't get a remote for it? I mean, come on. But basically, yeah, we end with Ben on the planet alone with the assumption that everybody else, both the heroes and the villains and so forth, got home fine.
Yeah.
Now, this set off Ben on Battleworld for the remainder of the Thing title, which went through another, 20 issues or something thereabouts.
Yeah, and then when he comes back with that really weird suit about the time Johnny's marrying Alicia.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think he gets back for the wedding. Exactly.
Yeah, because at that point, Battleworld's crumbling around him or whatever. It's interesting because at this point, only one chunk of the planet has gone back, and that was the one that Molecule Man took. So presumably for the duration of the Thing series, there are a bunch of planets that are missing chunks of them because they were borrowed for Battleworld. But I mean, so much just in this one issue happens. And again, oversized, that certainly helped. But throughout the 12 issues of this series, it does not slow down. A lot happens. Some of it makes a little more sense than others. Absolutely. Some of it you've got to kind of read a little into, maybe. But it's fun. It's a great roller coaster ride. And it was the initial Marvel event. And I would go so far as to say that perhaps without this comics as we know them would be fundamentally different. We would not be having, you know, the Empire event that's going on these days. We would not have had, obviously, the second Secret Wars, the third Secret Wars, the Secret War that the Nick Fury thing had, or the other Secret War that we had a few years ago, or House of M, or Age of Ultron, or, you know, list off any of the zillion other events that we've had, Fear itself, etc. Civil War, Civil War II, Civil War III, whenever that happens, and you know it's going to. Whether they number it three or not, we'll have another one. So for me, this was just a ton of fun. It really got me into the Marvel Universe, and, you know, I've been a happy reader of it ever since.
Yep, it's weird. This is only the first time I've read this specifically. And no, I read it when I first bought this book, but this is the second time I've read it, and it's weird. I haven't read much immediately before it.
Mm-hmm.
I read stuff 5 to 6 years before it, and I read quite a bit of stuff after, but the year or two right before it is a pretty good blind spot for me.
Well, again, for me, I was reading the John Byrne stuff, which was Fantastic Four and Alpha Flight. I got into all of these titles as they were all, you know, entering or exiting the arena. So for me, the first Spider-Man I got off the rack was the first black costume.
Yep.
Now, I since went back and picked up a lot of earlier issues of Captain America, Avengers, Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, etc. But the continuity of that time is a little hazy for me, partially because I was reading some of it out of order, and partially because so much of it was so new that it took me a while to kind of build up the context.
Yeah.
You know, but I was enjoying this era of Iron Man quite a bit. I thought it was some terrific stuff. But I would argue that the mid-80s, for me, was just a great time for comics, both at Marvel, DC, and the other publishers.
Yeah. And that's the other thing you say. It changed comics. And one could certainly argue that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
DC's first major event is about to start, or might have already started at this point. And I don't feel like it was a stolen idea. It was kind of like a concurrent similar idea.
Well, and those sorts of concurrent similar ideas had happened before.
Exactly.
With Doom Patrol and the X-Men.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I think Crisis happens with or without this. And then you can argue events happen with or without either one of them, possibly.
I would say the precursor to both of them was Contest of Champions.
Yes.
And James and I are going to talk about that one in a couple of weeks, I think.
Awesome. That'll be fun.
And that was a prototype of this sort of event where you get a bunch of heroes and stuff together for literally a contest that some godlike beings, I think it was the Game Master and one of the other elders of the universe or whatever, were doing. But to me, that was almost a Marvel riff on a JLA-JSA team-up. Let's gather everybody together and then split them off into teams to go do a mission or two, and then we'll gather back up and save the day.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of set the stage. I think that your point about Crisis on Infinite Earths happening around this time, again, I'd have to go check the calendars as to when what came out. Crisis was going to happen anyways without this, I think. I don't know. If this came out first, and again, I think it did, but I by maybe a year or so. So at that point, the Crisis stuff probably would have already been under discussion. I just don't know if Crisis would have happened the same sort of way or not as a 12-issue series that, you know, gathered everybody together and kind of did some of what Secret Wars did, but I don't say for reals, but not off on a battle planet or whatever. The stakes were high, the stakes were real, and it impacted everything.
I'm just taking a quick look. This issue came out April of 85.
So I think this preceded.
And Crisis comes out the exact same.
Yeah.
So Crisis 1 and Secret Wars 12 arguably are on the stands the same.
I have to think that they were looking at what Marvel was doing, knowing they wanted to revamp their continuity at DC, and the form of a 12-issue structure and stuff like that, I'm not saying was taken from Secret Wars, but I think they were watching what Marvel was doing and adapting and learning and whatnot where it made sense.
Yeah, possibly.
But the plans for Crisis had been building for quite some time.
Exactly.
Marv Wolfman had been planting the seeds for it for at least a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah. So actually, there's more overlap than I thought. Secret Wars 12 comes out 2 weeks after Crisis. So it's January 3rd and January 7th for Crisis 1 and January 17th for this issue.
I would argue, though, that both...
I said, there's just some overlap.
No,
I don't,
no, no.
I don't, I think they were concurrent ideas. I don't think they were really stealing from each other.
No, I don't think they were stealing. I think they did very different things, but I think they also set the stage for the events at each company. Because the events we tend to get at Marvel are a coming together of all the heroes to go fight some overwhelming thing. Maybe it's villains, maybe it's not. Whereas at DC, the very fate and state of existence is put into question by their events. You know, of Crisis, of Zero Hour, of Doomsday Clock, of Infinite Crisis, and a few of the others they've had.
Absolutely. No, that I do. Plus, I think Marvel, after arguably the lack of success of Secret Wars 2, and Marvel tried some other things with their events.
Well, I think they had enough success with Secret Wars 2 to do Secret Wars 3. I think they had weaker stories for those titles, and they went overboard on the crossovers. The whole bit when I was referring to Cap getting vaporized and put back together, we saw that exact sort of thing play out with the New Mutants in Secret Wars 3, where the Beyonder just killed them multiple times to help them grow.
Yes, but what I think is interesting is at that point, Marvel shifts, and you get things like Atlantis Attacks.
You get the annual events in terms of events, not only annually, but inside of the annuals.
Exactly. You got a Marvel then began to play with some different structures than the 12-issue miniseries at that point.
Well, yeah, and I think it also went back to its roots of a different style of shared universe than DC tends to have, where you would have a family of three or four titles, and they would cross over in their annuals for their, you know, summer event or something like that.
Yep.
It was not something that in the 90s we had the big major event every year that everything crossed over to, the way we've kind of had for most of the last decade or two.
Yeah, no, and then in the 90s you had those major events, but they were, like you like to say, more family focused. You know, you get like the Onslaughts, and you know, you get Nightfall,
mm-hmm.
things like that at the two companies, which are kind of big events, but they're different than this style of event or a Crisis style event.
I guess for me, I tend to reserve, and this is just me, so people can use terms however they want, but I tend to reserve the term event for something that is effectively line-wide, where all the heavy hitters in the universe are there. Now, you could argue with Secret Wars, no Daredevil, no Power Man and Iron Fist, no Defenders.
Well, but you had the Hulk.
Yeah, you had the Hulk. But I would say their heavy hitters were the ones we got here.
Yes.
So.
No magic user.
Doctor Strange. Did he have a title at that point? I think so.
No, but he wasn't in this event.
Yeah, yeah. But that's my point, is there are a few people that arguably you could have gotten based on the lineup of titles Marvel had at the time here for it to classify as the sort of event I'm talking, where if you're anybody that's anybody, you're involved.
Yeah.
And that's typically how a War of the Gods, a War of the Realms, a Age of Ultron, or, you know, any of those sort of Armageddon 2001 sort of events or branded storylines or whatever happen at Marvel and DC. Whoever's being published, they're sucked into it. It's the rare exception that doesn't. And I'm not saying it's got to be 100% of the characters or the titles or whatever, but that to me is an event, whereas something like the Nightfall stuff over at Batman, or the Atlantis Attacks that hit a couple of titles in Marvel, or the Mutant Massacre, which hit the Mutant titles, those hit almost an editorial office or a small pocket of books or titles, and not like everybody under the sun. Even if they've got a few, it's like, oh, I wouldn't have expected him, but he's here, but it's not like everybody.
Yeah.
So to me, an event is if you were to, 6 months afterwards, bump into a random hero, you could bring up the, hey, what'd you think about the Beyonder? Oh yeah, man, Battleworld, and be able to have a discussion with them versus get the, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
But I definitely think this was one of the instigating event titles, certainly at Marvel, that colored how they did events to this day.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was a ton of fun. I think they had a solid creative team. I think it is more of a roller coaster ride than a methodical, we have a well-plotted story that we will get, you know, character arcs and everything and clear plot progression. It will all make perfect sense and stuff. I didn't expect that out of this. This was to sell toys. And it sold toys, and it sold a ton of comics. That's why they did Secret Wars 2. That's why they did Secret Wars 3. It worked. And just anecdotally, for me, it absolutely worked. I was a DC reader before this. I was a DC and Marvel reader after this. So definite success for them on that count. So it's one of those things that I think if you're a Marvel fan and you have not read this, you owe it to yourself to do it. It's a nice look at an earlier point in the Marvel history. It's a ton of fun, and it is just a clear mile marker in the Marvel continuity.
Absolutely. No question about that.
So coming up, we've got the preview spotlight. The deadline for that is going to be a Saturday morning, July 4th. As we're recording this on the 25th, previews came out yesterday. I've actually got my copy now. A lot of the Marvel stuff is still stuff that they'd announced a month or two or three or four back that they're still getting out through the pipeline and whatnot. But there's some cool new stuff, so hopefully people will send in some clips and we can start to get those episodes firing on all cylinders again. We had a lower turnout last month. Just again, a lot of the stuff wasn't so new, so I totally get why that happened, but I'd love for more involvement. And we still have the recommendation roundtable going on. That's basically another opportunity for you to share things you enjoy, be it comics, older comics in that case, novels, television shows, movies, video games, anything of the sort. If it's something that you think the Comic Book Page audience would find of interest because it's kind of geek related or whatever, maybe it's a show on streaming you've seen and think people would enjoy or what have you, great place to share your love of that and get other people hooked on it too.
Absolutely.
So anything else?
No, I'm good.
Cool.
Join us next week as James and I look at Morning Glories numbers 1-6. And in 2 weeks, as Sam and I start to take a look at the Squadron Supreme series from the 1980s.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.